You're listening to Gossip Int, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossip Int is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today, we have Karen Frost and Caitlin Hopkins. Karen Frost is a senior threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ, a Microsoft company. And previously, she spent 11 years working in the federal government. For the last 6 years, she's also been a freelance pop culture journalist. Caitlin Hopkins is a threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ. She has a master's degree in applied intelligence, and she spent 4 years in analytic positions working for the government and private sector. And I'm Diana Duviel. I'm a senior threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ, and I spent 10 years as an analyst in the federal government. Although all three of our participants today work for Microsoft, the views expressed on this podcast belong to us alone, and they do not represent the views of Microsoft. So this week's topic is deception detection. Karen, that sounds like a law enforcement topic. Why would we talk about it in a critical thinking context?
Deception is very much a critical thinking issue because we deal with it all the time. Our kids lie to us, our significant others may lie, even our employers or fellow employees may lie. We might think we've got a pretty good handle on knowing when someone is lying or telling the truth, but it turns out we don't. All humans are really bad at detecting deception. Research has consistently shown that people's ability to detect lies is no more accurate than flipping a coin. And this is true for everyone: students, psychologists, judges, job interviewers, even law enforcement personnel. That's really interesting because aside from whatever we think about our own ability to sniff out lies, we assume that because some people are consistently exposed to lies, for example, police officers, they must develop some sort of a sixth sense about it, right? The fact that they don't reinforces how important it is to develop a framework for deception detection that moves this issue from a subjective gut feeling to objective criteria.
So you mean to say that police can't just look at a criminal and know they're lying based on their micro expressions or something? But I mean, isn't that the basis of entire TV shows?
It's an interesting paradox. Not just police, but even intelligence agencies operate on the theory that individuals who are lying will exhibit stress-based clues because they experience subconscious cognitive distress about lying. So traditionally, officers are trained to look for things like posture shifts, gaze aversion, crossed arms, etc. Basically, they're looking for unusual body language, something out of place given the circumstances. Sometimes these clues really do give away the culprit, but we also have to recognize that sometimes they don't. For example, someone can exhibit these behaviors even though they're innocent just because they're terrified of being questioned by police, or they're guilty but don't exhibit these behaviors. If body language isn't a reliable indicator, we have to find a more reliable indicator. This leads us to lie detector tests administered by polygraph machines. Modern polygraph machines are computerized systems that continuously monitor blood pressure, heart rate, respiration, and perspiration. They work based on the theory that liars will have a subconscious physiological response to lying. In essence, the fear of their lies being detected causes increased activation of a liar's sympathetic nervous system. That's the fight or flight response. This activation then leads to an increase in heart rate, blood pressure, respiration, and perspiration, all of which are detectable. So while a police officer may be watching to see if a criminal winces when shown evidence of their guilt or something like that, the polygraph machine is monitoring the parts of the body a police officer can't see with their eyes. Well, the question is, are they any more effective than body language? And the answer is yes. According to the American Polygraph Association, polygraphs are about 87% accurate. Of course, that's going to be a little bit of bias there. Of course, they're going to say something like that. So the U.S. government commissioned the National Academy of Sciences to investigate how effective polygraphs were. And the Academy found the rate to be closer to 75%. That's definitely better than chance, but it's also why polygraphs are considered inadmissible in criminal court cases.
So what I'm hearing is that machines are better at reading people than other humans are. Why is that?
That's a good question, and one that we don't have a great answer for. According to Tim Levin, a professor of communication studies and researcher at the University of Alabama, humans didn't evolve to detect lies. We evolved to give the benefit of the doubt. We're social animals, so we have to place our trust in other people. That certainly sounds logical, but there are some other things we need to consider. One of these is the problem of implicit assumptions. Two researchers examined studies on deception detection and found that people have biases regarding behavior and body language that leads them to improperly weight them. Put another way, they judged some behaviors to be indicative of deception, whether they were or not. These were One, if the story being told didn't seem plausible or logical, or if the storyteller came off as indifferent, ambivalent, or uncertain. Two, if the individual seemed to be withholding information. Three, if the individual was tense. Four, if the individual was negative or unpleasant. What this means is that someone who seems grouchy and nervous, for example, when giving evidence as a witness, will be judged less credible than a smiling, happy person. While there's some correlation between being nervous and being guilty, it's the weighting of these cues that becomes disproportionate. That's what's tripping us up. Another reason the average person isn't good at detecting lies is that we don't practice enough to get consistent, useful feedback. So while we might know our significant other well enough to tell when they're lying, we don't tend to find ourselves in situations where we have to make a call whether someone else, a stranger, for example, is lying, and then get the answer so we learn from it.
So we can't just look at someone and see that they're guilty. And a polygraph is only accurate to a certain extent. So you might be asking, is there a structured analytic technique that we can use to identify if someone is lying? And the answer is yes. Deception or lying can be virtually undetectable if the person doing it is skilled. Because as Karen says, humans are terrible at detecting lies. So all it takes is a little acting and we're fooled. To counteract our inherent tendency to trust others, we could assume that everyone is lying, but that's not going to be super helpful either. It's the boy who cried wolf problem. So how can we strike a balance between this naive trust on the one hand and paranoia on the other? And that's where the analytic technique of deception detection comes in. Deception detection is a diagnostic checklist. It's a series of questions we can ask ourselves that helps us to get a handle on the current situation. So it's not about predicting what will happen next. It's about being in the moment and trying to understand what's happening. There are four parts to the deception detection structured analytic technique. The first, we have motive, means, and opportunity. So if a person has the motive, the opportunity, the means to deceive, the likelihood that we're being hoodwinked increases, although that doesn't guarantee that the person is being deceptive. If we can reliably rule out means or opportunities, the opposite is true. So for example, there's an odd trend whereby people confess to crimes they didn't commit. But if someone says they conducted a series of murders, but they weren't even in the country when the murders occurred, that's obviously a problem. They definitely didn't have the opportunity. So the second part is past opposition practices. In other words, what's the person's track record? Does the person have a reputation for ends justify the means type of behavior? Or does the person act with integrity, even in circumstances which would tempt others to perhaps broadly interpret the truth? For example, your child claims they didn't eat the last cookie and leave the empty package on the counter. But the last three times you found an empty cookie wrapper, they were the culprit. So even if they managed to wipe the crumbs off their mouth this time, this pattern of past behavior increases the likelihood your child's trying to deceive you. And third part here we have is the manipulability of sources. This involves asking questions like, is what the person's saying plausible? Are there any safety measures in place to prevent the person from falsifying what they're saying? Is the ultimate source of the person's information vulnerable to manipulation? Does the person have direct access to the information, etc.? So, for example, let's say your employee comes in with a doctor's note to justify their absence. Is it possible they forged the note using a template on the internet because they just didn't feel like coming into work? The fourth and final step is to take a look at the information or evidence itself. It's important that this step comes last because, again, applying this critical thinking technique is about trying to overcome our biases. If the story the person is telling us sounds convincing and it fits our existing model of how we interpret the world, we might easily just fall into the trap of believing it right off the bat. But those three previous steps, they force us to take a step back and approach with some newfound skepticism, evaluating the information itself. So what is the chain of evidence, for example, looking at how the evidence was collected, evaluated, transmission? Can the story be corroborated? Are there any additional sources of information that can provide credibility? And is there any information we would expect to see that is conspicuous by its absence? Now that we have sort of the fundamentals of what deception detection looks like, Karen, to what pop culture examples can we apply this?
We're going to apply it to actor Jussie Smollett's fabricated claim that he was a victim of a hate crime. Now, ordinarily, we would never accuse someone of fabricating something like that. That's slander. In this unique case, however, Smollett was charged and convicted of doing just that. So although he continues to protest his innocence, given the conviction, I think we're on steady ground to describe the situation that way. So let's start with a very brief description of what happened according to the report that Smollett filed with the police and later accounts he gave in interviews. On January 29, 2019, Smollett claimed he was attacked by two white men in downtown Chicago at 2 a.m. as he was walking home from a Subway restaurant. According to Smollett, his attackers shouted racist and homophobic slurs at him, put a thin rope around his neck like a noose, and poured bleach on him before running off while shouting, "This is MAGA country." MAGA, of course, being the acronym for Make America Great Again. Now, let's get into applying the deception, detection, structured analytic technique to this account. The criteria I'm going to use are framed slightly differently from how you, Diana, framed them, but they represent the same ideas. The first question we have to ask ourselves has to do with criticality. So in this case, is there anything in this story that would force us to have to alter or challenge our key assumptions in order to trust the information? In Smollett's case, the answer is yes, and has to do with the circumstances of the alleged crime. Smollett reported he was getting a Subway sandwich at 2 a.m. because he landed 4 hours late from New York and was hungry. At the time, the outside temperature was an absolutely freezing negative 11 degrees Fahrenheit. Winter in Chicago is brutal. So to believe Smollett's story about being attacked, we have to believe that two men were hanging around Chicago at a time everyone else is normally asleep, with a bottle of bleach and a noose, waiting to attack Smollett specifically. And we know that if Smollett's story is true, they must have actively targeted him, because if it was a random race-related hate crime, they wouldn't have known he was gay and yelled homophobic slurs during the attack. So already, there's some question here. But how did the attackers know that he would be awake and would leave the apartment building at 2 a.m.? Is it realistic to think that two strangers waited for hours in sub-zero temperatures on the hopes that Smollett would want a sandwich or would otherwise leave his apartment? The second thing we have to consider as part of deception detection is whether Smollett had the motive, opportunity, and means to fake the attack. In this case, Smollett had been very vocal on social media about a variety of topics, including his dislike of MAGA supporters, racism, and homophobia. He was also trying to drum up publicity for his budding music career, and, as law enforcement later speculated, was also likely trying to have his salary on the show Empire increased. So in this case, we might have been able to say he had a possible motive. Now we have the question of opportunity. Did he have the opportunity to set up a fabricated hate crime? Sure, we could say that he did. Theoretically, anyone could, so that's not particularly diagnostic. The same is true for the means. Yes, he certainly had money and contacts that would enable him to fake an attack. So these three questions, we could say, yes, he might have had the motive, opportunity, and means to stage a fake attack against himself. Next, we have the question of reliability. Did Smollett have a history of deception that would make his current story less likely to be true? This isn't necessarily a diagnostic question, because even if the answer was no, that doesn't mean he wasn't lying this time. In this case, however, the answer is yes. In 2007, Smollett pleaded no contest to several charges, including providing false information to a police officer and false impersonation. And for this faked attack, police immediately had questions about Smollett's reliability. In particular, they flagged three pieces of behavioral evidence that they found raised questions about his reliability. First, despite what he claimed to have been a savage, traumatizing attack, he was still carrying his sandwich from Subway. According to police, most real victims will abandon anything in their hands during the effort to escape their attackers. Smollett not only was still carrying his sandwich, however, it wasn't even squished during the alleged tussle, nor did he have any injuries beyond a small scratch below his eye, which was later determined to be self-inflicted. For a vicious attack, he was suspiciously calm and collected. Second, Smollett was still wearing the noose-like tie when police arrived 45 minutes after the attack. Many people found it incredible that he wouldn't remove it the second he was safely away from his attackers. And third, he refused to turn over his cell phone to police. When he finally submitted his phone records, they were in the form of a limited and redacted PDF file. While he claimed this was to protect his, quote, powerful friends, it was unnecessary and alerting for what should have been a simple assault case. Next, we have the question of responsiveness. This is what Diana called the manipulation of sources. Did Smollett respond to police requests for information, or did he try to manipulate with that information? While Smollett claimed to have cooperated, it took him over a week to turn over those phone records. And as noted, they were purposely incomplete. In addition, he refused to turn over his medical records or submit a DNA sample. Thus, we might say Smollett was not responsive and helpful, and he did try to manipulate the information that he gave. Finally, we have the question of timing. Is the information coming at a time when it would be particularly beneficial for the giver in some way? In this case, the answer is, again, yes. 4 days after the alleged attack, Smollett had a concert in West Hollywood. Before the attack, ticket sales were lackluster. After the attack, crowds lined up around the block. But the attack was also likely tied to salary negotiations for the next season of Empire, which was coming to an end.
Sounds like there were a lot of red flags in this case. So what really happened?
What police quickly determined was that Smollett had staged the attack with the help of two Nigerian immigrant brothers he knew who had worked as extras in Empire and who occasionally sold him drugs and provided physical training. He paid them $3,500 for their role in the hoax. Police eventually obtained footage of the brothers buying the gloves, ski masks, and red hats for the attack from a clothing store. And they got the receipt for the rope they bought from a hardware store. Police also found footage of Smollett taking the brothers on a dry run the day before the attack. The brothers later testified that they had rehearsed the attack with Smollett and that Smollett had pointed out the security cameras that were meant to capture the attack. Although ironically, they ended up being pointed in the wrong direction. So although everything else on his walk to and from Subway was captured on CCTV, that exact 50-second attack was not captured. Smollett told the brothers he wanted them to attack him, but to pull their punches when they did. He didn't want to be seriously hurt. Ultimately, Smollett was tried and found guilty of 5 counts of disorderly conduct, in essence lying to the police. Smollett's downfall, it would seem, was likely in his assumption that he could keep the police out of the hoax. Per the brothers, Smollett's original plan had been to obtain the security camera footage from the attack and post it on social media to raise his profile. Once police became involved, however, it was impossible to keep up the deception without tipping them off to inconsistencies in the story.
Man, what a story. Caitlin, what's our tech example?
For our tech-focused example, we're going to apply deception detection to Elizabeth Holmes and how she defrauded investors in her medical diagnostics company, Theranos. Like Karen said, we typically would never accuse someone of fraud. However, in January 2022, Holmes was charged with and convicted of both wire fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud by lying to investors to raise money for Theranos. Like Smollett, Holmes maintains that she is innocent. But in light of these convictions, I think we're able to discuss the situation in terms of her being guilty. So for listeners unfamiliar with the story, Elizabeth Holmes founded her medical diagnostic company, Theranos, in 2003, when she was 19, after dropping out of Stanford University. Theranos' mission was to develop less invasive laboratory testing technologies and services. And most notably, Theranos claimed to produce lab technology that could run over 1,000 medical tests for an individual using just a few drops of blood. This medical device, called the Edison, would revolutionize healthcare by slashing costs and making blood draws faster and less painful. Theranos was what's called a unicorn, a private company with a valuation of over $1 billion. And in fact, at its height, it was called the Apple of healthcare and valued at around $10 billion. Investors included big names like Rupert Murdoch, Henry Kissinger, the Walton family, and former U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Theranos was flying high, and Holmes was being profiled as the next Steve Jobs. But then things came crashing down. By 2015, Theranos had become the subject of harsh scrutiny as whistleblowers and news outlets began reporting that the Edison did not work. But was this a minor technological bump in the road on the way to some groundbreaking invention, or was this just a massive fraud? So let's say that we were an investor and we were concerned that she might be engaging in deception. How would we apply the deception detection technique? First, we would need to decide if Holmes had the motive, the opportunity, and the means to defraud investors. Of course, now we have the advantage of hindsight to help us make that call, but Holmes' likely motivation was a mix between reputational and financial personal gain. She was dubbed the world's youngest self-made female billionaire and lived a lavish, jet-setting life that needed funding. And further, she enjoyed the recognition that she gained by being known as a Steve Jobs-esque Silicon Valley CEO. Startups can be very vulnerable to fraud, as evidenced by the various forms of fraud showcased in the Netflix show Inventing Anna. And this might be perhaps because of the ease of fudging legitimate and illegitimate business ideas. So in the moment, we might have said that Holmes could have had the motivation to deceive, just like any successful high-profile CEO. but next we can look at her opportunity and her means. As the founder and CEO of Theranos, Holmes definitely had both the opportunity and the means to defraud those around her. She had control over the lab results that she shared with investors, and she could easily fabricate them. So right off the bat, we would know that this is a situation that requires some more scrutiny. Now we look at Holmes' past opposition practices, or as Diana said, her track record. Did Holmes have a history of deceptive behavior that may have indicated she was deceiving investors? This is what Karen called reliability. And in this case, the answer is absolutely. In what should have been a red flag, Holmes often used vague, deflective, or invasive statements to describe the Edison and some of the other technologies that Theranos was developing. In one interview, Holmes described the Edison by saying, a chemistry is performed so that a chemical reaction occurs and generates a signal from the chemical interaction with the sample, which is translated into a result, which is then reviewed by certified laboratory personnel. Very confusing. And while one could argue that Holmes was vague because the technology was proprietary and she valued secrecy, it's more likely that she was evasive because the technology and the process simply didn't work. But to that more subjective data, we have hard data as well. In 2015, Safeway canceled a deal with Theranos after many missed deadlines and questionable lab results. Starting in 2013, Theranos claimed to have conducted blood tests on patients for GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer, but in 2015, these two companies had said they had no active projects with the company. All of these argue against Holmes' reliability. So next, we determine the manipulability of the sources. In this case, Holmes' position as founder and CEO gave her direct access to information like test and trial data, financial projections, and service contracts. This position allowed her to manipulate and falsify this information as needed. Therefore, we could say that her ability to manipulate sources was high. And while an investor might not have the technological savvy to know when data was being manipulated, in May 2015, University of Toronto professor Eleftherios Dimandis analyzed Theranos' technology and concluded that most of the company's claims were exaggerated. Here might be a good place to mention that Theranos had never published any peer-reviewed research in medical research literature, something that was definitely a huge red flag.
So we see that there were multiple red flags over the course of several years, but Holmes was trying to hide those flags. So what happened in this case to expose the fraud?
Well, in October 2015, an employee acting as a whistleblower contributed to a Wall Street Journal article exposing that Theranos was using traditional blood testing machines rather than the Edison because the Edison wasn't working as promised. This sparked multiple business partners to investigate, as well as the FBI, SEC, and the FDA. They found that Holmes had knowingly made false statements to investors and potential investors about the Edison. The company hid the device's poor performance by swapping Edison test results with those from blood draws conducted on other companies' devices. Holmes claimed that other pharmaceutical companies had validated Theranos' test results for the Edison, but they were exposed as lies. Holmes was also shown to have completely misrepresented Theranos' financial position and future business prospects, and she used Pfizer's logo and letterhead on lab results to insinuate a contract with the medical giant, and also she touted large, revenue-generating contracts with the United States Department of Defense when they were moderately sized at best. Throughout 2016, the house of cards continued to fall down, and eventually, after a 15-week trial, jurors found Holmes guilty of three charges of wire fraud and one charge of conspiracy to commit wire fraud. One thing I want to highlight is the extent of the deception here. In July 2015, then Vice President Biden was invited to tour the Theranos lab. However, the lab he was shown was literally a set. It was a room that had been repainted and outfitted with a variety of fancy-looking equipment to appear to be an automated lab, hiding the fact that Theranos was using commercial equipment it had bought from other companies. So deception isn't just words. It can also be fake rooms or even fake buildings.
We often have the perception that it's harder to perpetuate frauds and hoaxes in the modern era, and so individuals will be less likely to attempt them. With cell phones, the internet, Wikipedia, all of these things lead us to the false belief that we'll be able to detect fraud sooner. In the case of Theranos, however, we see that's not true, nor are regular civilians deterred from fraud. In November 2016, for example, an American woman named Sherry Papini disappeared while out jogging in California. 3 weeks later, she reappeared on the side of the road, allegedly having been freed by her captors. The sensational story made national news, but it turned out Papini had made up the whole thing. She'd been staying with an ex-boyfriend during her absence. In March 2022, Papini was arrested for making false statements to federal law enforcement officers, and she eventually signed a plea deal admitting she'd orchestrated the hoax. Today's episode used the deception detection checklist, but there's another, possibly even more effective technique that can be used to catch liars in the act. According to Ray Bull, a professor of criminal investigation at the University of Derby, liars face a dilemma. They have to fabricate a lie without knowing what the investigator or listeners actually know. As a result, if the investigator slowly reveals details, the liar has to keep making up new excuses. In essence, it increases the chances that they'll dig themselves into a hole. The investigator can make this process even harder on the liar by increasing the liar's cognitive load by asking them to tell the story in reverse order or out of chronological order. Someone telling the truth can easily tell their story in any order, but a liar will struggle to remember all the fabricated details. They'll also speak more slowly with less detail as they attempt to process their tale. So just by changing this one thing, we have a better chance of drawing out telltale mistakes. This might be useful to know if you're ever in a situation where you need to find out who ate the last cookie from the cookie jar.
The structured analytic technique that we'll be looking at in the next episode is called signposts and indicators. We'll be talking about how we can apply this extremely useful structured technique both retroactively and predictively. Thanks for listening, and catch you on the flip side.